The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I have to tell this little story. Because when I wrote How to Cook Everything and first went on the road in 1999, so exactly 10 years ago, I was practically a kid. And I had done a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but I was going to television shows and showing them how to cook, but still I didn't feel like exactly an author. And then someone in Toronto invited me to be on a late night talk show. So I was like, Letterman, you know, and I was told this guy, he's the Conan of Canada. So I thought this is going to be great. And they said, oh, he's kind of funny. I said, well, yeah, I like funny. He said, he might make fun of you. I said, it's okay, I'm sorry. So I go there and it's live. I go there and he says, I'm going to have you do a reading from your book. I said, that's pretty interesting. It's a cookbook, which he knew. He said, I want you to read from this page. I said, whatever you want. I mean, what are you going to do? You're sitting there. So he gives me he opens the book to the section about, I think it's called colanders, strainers, and other straining objects or something. Here, read this. So I did. That was pretty funny. And book tour for Food Matters is the first time that I've actually gotten to be in front of people talking seriously and saying things that I've thought for a long time, but didn't exactly have the place in which I could say them. That's another story. But so now I can do a reading that I like, but I don't really like readings because I think that people should be able to say something different when they're in front of an audience than they say in their writing. So I'm going to do a very quick reading. And in fact, it's as unliterary. It's a list. If you have a copy of this or get one, you can find this list, or you can also find it on the USDA's website. It's a fabulous list. It's called, this is not very dramatic, but this is what it's called, the top 10 foods contributing to energy intake in the U.S. population. So in other words, if we were doing it, it's a top 10 list of the foods from which we get most of our calories in order. I'm going to pause for a second and first take a sip of water. I seem nervous. It must be Philadelphia. I like Philadelphia. Someone accused me of not liking Philadelphia. I actually feel very at home in Philadelphia. I've always liked Philadelphia. I'm not saying that just so you'll like me. I happen to be true. Parents brought me here when I was like 7, and I liked it then, and I never stopped liking it. So it's close, too. There are a few things that everyone, at least Americans, is neurotic about. Everyone is. Americans are neurotic about. Let's just say, take the most obvious, sex, sleep, money, and food. No one's going to put up much of a fight about those things. So if you think about sex all the time and have sex every time you think about it, you are a sexaholic or a sex addict or a nymphomaniac or whatever you want to call it. If you fall asleep every time you're tired or go to sleep every time you think you might like to go to sleep, you're a narcoleptic or you are diagnosed as having a problem. If you spend money every time you think about money, you're a shopaholic, or if you feel like you must make money every time you think about money, you're a workaholic. But if you eat every time you think about eating, you're an American. That's a new line. You heard it first. So what do you eat if you're an American? Number one, soft drinks. The largest percentage of caloric intake in the United States is attributed to soft drinks. 7% of our national caloric intake, 7%, which is not that far from 10%, so it's like a lot, right? Soda, completely useless nutritionally and bad for you. Number two, cake, sweet rolls, donuts, etc. I think donuts is probably, you know, the USDA doesn't prioritize in these categories, but let's say donuts. Number three, hamburgers and cheeseburgers. Number four, pizza. Number five, chips. Number six, rice, which is almost food. Number seven, rolls, bagels, the new bane of our existence, especially those of us who grew up with real bagels. Number eight, cheese or cheese spread, and we're not talking about foam d'Ambert here. Number nine, beer. Very important food group. And number 10, French fries, which is, aside from the little bit of tomatoes you might find on a pizza, the only vegetable in this group. Let's look at the same information a little bit differently. These are the top 10 food groups contributing to energy intake in the U.S. population. So not single foods, but groups of food. Number one, sweets. Number one. I mean, if you didn't know this or hadn't heard it, you'd sort of fall off a chair. I mean, if someone said to you, in France, they eat more sweets than anything else, you'd be surprised. Here, it's not a big deal. Number two, meat. Number three, bread, rolls, and crackers. Number four, mixed dishes. Only the USDA knows what that means. I mean, is that like donuts mixed with meat or... Number five is dairy. Number six, soft drinks. Number seven, vegetables. But I would wager anything, I keep meaning to do this work, but I would wager anything that the majority of that category is the French fries from the other category. You know this to be true, right? Number eight is chicken and fish. Number nine is alcoholic beverages, mostly beer, which was in ninth place over there also. And number 10 is fruit and juice, which probably mostly means juice, which probably mostly means high fructose corn syrup. That is the reading from Food Matters. Okay. What does this mean? I have two directions I can go here. I have to think. All right. What does this mean? Based on those lists, we eat about 3 pounds of food a day on average. That, to give you a sense of what that means, if you take like a really big burrito, like, you know, the kinds that are sort of the size of a small person's head, that weighs about a pound. So we eat about three of those a day. And if you think about it, you eat one of those at 9, 1, and 6. You're sort of not that hungry otherwise. I mean, you're eating a lot. So we eat about that much food a day. Now, here's a couple interesting statistics. That stuff down there, those, you break that chart down, and it turns out that a third of the calories we eat are useless, nutritionally worthless. If you look at things another way, we eat about a half a pound, 180 pounds a year per person, half a pound a day of meat. This is beef, pork, poultry, lamb. We also eat, this is the one that got me, because I said, well, what about other, this is quite recently, actually. I don't even think this is in this book. What about other animal products? Eggs, milk. You know, 4 glasses of milk a day, which everyone over 40 in this room was told they should be drinking, 4 glasses of milk actually weighs 2 pounds. I mean, a pint weighs a pound, and 4 8-ounce glasses is a quart. So there you go. So I said, How much, I wonder, other animal products do we eat? Well, it turns out to be 600 pounds a person a year, which is about pound and a half. So we eat 3 pounds. I mean, you have to understand, your life is probably not like this, but on average, all of our lives are like this. 3 pounds of food per day, 2 pounds of which is from animal products. Now, the donuts, the French fries, the pizza, all right, it has a little bit of cheese. The beer, the sweets in general, the soda, these are not animal products. So now you're looking at this scale or the seesaw or whatever you want to be looking at, and it looks like this. And the seesaw has your 2 pounds of animal products and your, let's say, roughly half a pound of crap that we eat every day, all of us eat every day. I mean, I'm saying it could be 7/8, so it could be that this side weighs just about 3 pounds and this side weighs almost nothing. But to make this argument a little more interesting, let's say this side weighs 2.5 pounds or so and this side weighs 0.5 pound or so, and on this side is poor old regular plants. And we're talking about fruit, vegetables, legumes, nuts, and whole grains. On this side, we're talking about animal products, all of them, junk, all of it, and highly processed stuff like white bread, which is not really, doesn't really, even though it is from grain, is really so processed that it's no longer has the benefits of grain and belongs more with junk food than with anything else. So what do these foods over here have in common? One of the things they have in common, aside from that they are dominant in our diet, one of the things they have in common is that they tend to be very caloric dense. Now, people argue you should eat a lot of meat or you should eat some meat because it's nutrient dense, and it is. Along with that comes caloric density. So the foods that are on this side of the equation, in addition to being dominant, are higher in calorie per weight, per unit of weight, than the foods on this side. So I'm going to say, and I think this is generous, I'm going to say 80% of the calories that the average person eats come from this side of the equation, and 20% come from this side of the equation. Now, I actually believe, I can't get an analysis that's close enough for me to state this as fact. But I personally believe that it's more like 90-10 if you started analyzing all this stuff. But let's say 80-20. Now, what is every nutritionist, dietitian, health professional, person who reads any of this stuff in the world think this thing ought to look like, the seesaw ought to look like? They think it ought to look like this. So we have it completely ass backwards. So that's sort of welcome to America. And I'm obviously not the first person to be saying this, but here I am saying it anyway. Now, what does this stuff over here mean? And I know I'm preaching to the converted here, so I'm gonna keep this kind of short. But what does this stuff over here mean? This is the crib sheet I left at home has my numbers on it, so I have to fudge numbers, or if I don't really remember the number, I'll say that it might not be completely accurate. But what does it mean? Here's one thing it means. 18% of greenhouse gases come directly or indirectly from industrial livestock production, which means 80% of global warming can be directly attributed to eating meat in industrialized countries. So that's, the 18% is a number I remember. So that's a UN number, which was called bullshit by some cattle lobbying groups. And then, lo and behold, last month, Scientific American came out with a study that said, oh, yeah, the UN number is exactly right. So this is not 18% cow farts or 18% slaughterhouse. Cow fart is like, if you're a comic, you know, you just get up and you say cow farts, everybody laughs, and you're a success. It's a lot of things. It's the fact that it takes 40 calories of energy to produce a calorie of beef protein. It takes 2 calories of energy to produce a calorie of corn protein. So you're using your calories of energy in a very inefficient way. There's a lot of energy inputs on the meat side, on the processed food side, on the dairy side. So there's a lot of that. The fact that it takes 50% of our corn and soy harvest, 50% in the United States, goes directly to feeding animals. Now, coincidentally, if that amount of food were turned into food for humans, remember the inefficiencies I was just talking about, 40 calories for beef, 2 calories for cow. If you took that 50% of the corn and soy that's grown in the United States only, and fed to animals, and turned that into edible food for humans, you could essentially solve the hunger problem worldwide. The hunger problem is not really a resource problem, it's a distribution problem. So, and there's another nice little statistic in there, which is that we have 1 billion overweight people globally and 1 billion starving people globally. So maybe it's just another seesaw, really. But that would work. So you have the global warming thing, you have the starvation thing, you have the food distribution thing, you have the fact that meat and dairy in particular are linked to high cholesterol, which is in turn linked to various coronary artery disease, heart disease, and stuff like that. Meat is directly linked to colon cancer. These are all things you know. The processed foods, especially sugars, but also simple carbohydrates, are linked to obesity. They're linked to diabetes, and so on down the line. You got hyperactive children. You got people with weird allergies. You got all the stuff that wasn't happening before. That stuff all is coming from this side of the seesaw. So what can we do about this? I mean, why did this happen? Again, I have to shortcut this because probably half of you have read Michael Pollan or seen my articles or heard this stuff anyway, but why did this happen? It happened because the USDA has had a dual role. Are there, like, machinery going on here? The USDA has had a dual role in our country's history. On the one hand, its job is to promote American agriculture, support it, make it strong, make it vibrant, make it profitable. On the other hand, it's supposed to educate us about what's good to eat. So there's a conflict of interest there. And guess what? The side with the money won. Not entirely. There are well-intentioned people at the USDA and good things come out of the USDA, but for the most part, the money won. And what the money did once it won was convince you, me, us, that the way to eat was 4 glasses of milk a day. You have to have at least 1 serving of meat every day. Cheese was really good for you, and so on down the line. And by the way, you might want to eat some fruits and vegetables to sort of just round things off. And when an impartial panel of USDA people in the late 60s, early 70s, found this not to really be true, the best recommendation they could make was eat less saturated fat. Now, there's no proof that saturated fat is actually bad for you. No study can confirm that saturated fat is bad for you. But everybody figured there were enough sort of fuzzy numbers out there that they could say, well, the bad thing about eating so many animal products is saturated fat. So what happened? The message came across, eat less saturated fat, so people cut the fat off of their meat, and they ate chicken instead of pork, and then they bred pork to be fat-free and taste-free as well. And then they invented, what were they called? Snackwells. I hadn't actually thought about this. They invented Snackwells, and see, what happened was they said, eat foods that are lower in fat. They didn't say eat less meat. They didn't say eat less caloric-dense stuff. They didn't say eat less crap. They didn't say eat more vegetables. They said eat foods that are lower in fat. So everybody said, okay, I can do that. Here are these great cookies that have no fat in them. So what if I can eat 1,000 calories worth of them at a sitting? And so someone said to me yesterday, what about Snackwells? I said, I actually think that was the beginning of the end. I mean, it was really incredible. And, you know, we do eat 25% more calories on average per person than we did 30 years ago, maybe 35 years ago, sometime in the 70s, which is, again, when all of this stuff started getting really bad. Sometime in the 70s, that changed. So 5 years ago, I saw some of this, not very clearly, but I write about food. I write about nutrition. I used to write about nutrition. And 5 years ago, so I saw this and I thought, this is unsustainable. I mean, now it's a no-duh. And maybe for many people then it was a no-duh also. But I thought, this typical American diet doesn't work now, and it's certainly not going to work in 5 or 10 years. It can't be sustained. So what can I do about it? Well, I didn't know what I could do about it. But so I wrote How to Cook Everything Vegetarian because I just wanted to be ready. I thought, I'll get ready. Something's going to happen. There's a lot of vegetarians out there. I'm not one of them. I'm not going to be one of them. I don't want to be one of them. But being better acquainted with vegetables is probably a good idea for somebody like me. So I wrote How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. By the time it came out, which was a year and a half ago, everything had changed. Everything had changed for me. I started cooking this stuff. I actually liked it. So guess what? I mean, I knew I liked it, but I liked it more. So I started eating it in place of things that I figured were not as good for me, not a new agey sense and not an old fashioned sense, but in a way it is quite old fashioned. I was eating my vegetables, right? And you know, you're going to stay pretty stable at your 3 pounds of food a day. So if a pound of that is, say, a half a pound of it is meat, and now a half a pound of it is lettuce, just to pick a vegetable, you changed everything. You changed your intake of calories, you changed your intake of protein versus non, of fiber versus non, of so on. You've changed everything mostly in a beneficial way. And that was kind of happening with me. And then two things happened at once. That UN report came out. So I saw this UN report, and I'm like, this is really happening in a catastrophic way. In fact, the first talk I gave on this subject was at a conference in California, and you could actually see this talk on the TED.com website, TED.com website. And my brilliant art director wife, who's not here tonight, did the visuals. And the first visual we did was a cow, this beautiful cow. And I said, how can it be that this beautiful cow could be the equivalent of, and then we had a mushroom cloud, this. So I was much more hyperbolic in those days. Now I'm very, very calm. I'm hardly ranting at all. But I was into it. I mean, I am into it. It was like the global warming thing. The meat production thing is second only to energy production in producing greenhouse gases, more than transportation. So, I mean, there's a factor of transportation in meat production, and you could probably make an argument about this, but 18% is a lot. No one's going to argue about that. So what was I going to do? I mean, I didn't really know what to do about this, but suddenly it felt much more serious. So then I went to my doctor. I was 57. I had just turned 57, or maybe I was about to turn 57. And I'd been pretty healthy. And Rick told this story, so I don't even have to tell this story. So shortcut to the point where he says to me, he wouldn't call me fat. You're overweight. Cholesterol's too high. It never was too high before. Your blood sugar's too high. You have diabetes in your family. You have sleep apnea and your knees are going. What do these things have in common? I don't know. He says, lose weight. So, okay. So I looked at all of these things that were going on in my life and things that I thought were going on in the world. And there were some other things that were percolating inside of me, too. And you all probably know me from other work, not even the Food Matters stuff. So look at what I do. I travel around. I eat in great places. I eat tons of funky food. I cook with terrific people. I cook by myself, which is less exciting, but I produce some decent stuff. And my life has revolved around this, and I thought, there's another thing that's been going on here, which is that I also am eating less meat because it kind of sucks. It's not as good as it used to be. And everybody knows it's not as good as it used to be, like it's watery and the pork has no flavor. They bred all the flavor out of it, and the beef is really not very good at all. I mean, it's either mushy or tough, and it's generally tasteless no matter which. And the chicken, God knows, I mean, even 10 years ago, no one in their right mind was eating commercially processed chicken when they could avoid it. And then I look at all of this, and I had written about veal raised in crates 20 years ago. And then I just, you know, it was something that was somehow like a little thing to me, and I thought, yeah, this is really terrible, and I wrote about it. And then I kind of forgot. And the intervening time between 20 years ago and 15 years ago, the number of pigs raised in confinement as opposed to not increased by 2,000%. So now, and cows too. So now all, and chickens we all know, You take a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, piece of paper 8.5 by 11, that's the amount of space a chicken has to live in. So, you know, we all know about these horrors, and I knew about them too, but this was sort of starting to come together for me, and I am not a person who was averse to eating animals, and I was able, like most Americans, to compartmentalize this stuff and say, well, they're subhuman, so therefore their suffering doesn't mean that much to me. And but then I started feeling like, well, even if it doesn't mean that much to me, it means a little bit to me. I don't hate animals, so it's not like I want to see them tortured. And then the number of animals raised in the United States annually turns out to be 10 billion. Billion. Okay, so that's a lot of animals. You know, I'm thinking, that's a lot of animals. And so the animals are like, we're raising these animals in horrible conditions, which you can't even really talk about because they're so disgusting. I had trouble even writing about it. I had trouble researching it. There's the global warming thing. There's the individual health thing. And by the way, the individual health thing is very closely related to not all of, but a part of, a significant part of our national health care crisis, because it's like, you know, we're paying health care for people who smoke cigarettes, and that gets raised as an issue from time to time, but we're also paying for health care for people who have diets that are actually dangerous to themselves and to, therefore to the rest of us. So there's, you know, I get confused because there's like so many, there's a lot of issues going on here, and they're all tied together. And at the end of the day, there's part of this is very much like oil, because oil is a scarce resource that's becoming increasingly scarce, and increasingly the market for it is becoming increasingly competitive. Well, the same is true of meat. Here's another cool thing. I have to look this up, but these are close numbers. These are not exact numbers. America is about 5% of the world's population, I believe, and we use 20 to 25%, I believe, of all the energy in the world. We also consume 1/6 of the world's meat. So about 20%, 18 or 20% of the world's meat, again, to 5% of the population. There are 10 billion animals, as I said, killed in the United States every year, and 60 billion worldwide. But just like oil, as countries like India and China get more money, there's never been a period in the time, never been a period in history when people didn't become wealthier and want to eat more meat. Maybe never as strong. But for the most part, that's the way things have happened. So as people in India and China become more middle class, they want to eat more meat. So now you have these demands, the demands of hundreds of millions of new middle class, or whatever you want to call them, people with money they didn't have before, wanting to compete with us for the meat that we feel we should be able to eat. So now the projections, these again are UN projections, are that we're going to be needing to fulfill the demand, the increase in global demand for meat, we're going to be needing 120 billion animals per year globally as opposed to 60 billion. Well, guess what? This can't happen. First of all, we can't afford the increase in greenhouse gases, but even if we could figure out a way around that, you know, sequester the carbon or whatever that stuff is, but even if we could figure out a way around that, the land isn't there, because as it happens, the 60 billion animals a year we're killing right now use directly or indirectly 70% of the arable land on the earth, 70. So you can double 60 to 120 very easily, because those are not percentages. Those are fixed numbers. But you can't increase 70% to 140% because the land isn't there. So at some point, I don't know when and I don't know how and I don't know what, at some point something is going to give. Sorry. We could do sound effects. So I had all this stuff going on in my head. And it seemed to be pointing in, you know, one of those like arrows in a dream. Mark, eat less meat. So I made up this little plan for myself. And I'm very bad at following moderate rules, but very good at following odd, strict rules. So this is not everybody's plan, and I'm going to get to what, what plans ought to be. There are actually three or four more points I need to make, and then we can do questions. I might ask a question first of you, though. But this was my plan, and as I said, I'm a little strange. Like I thought a few years ago, I thought I had a drinking problem. So I tried to cut back on, you know, I was drinking wine with dinner and sometimes with lunch and sometimes a lot, but not every day. And my kids would say, "Dad, you're not an alcoholic." I know. I just have to go home and go to bed now. So I'd make these rules, like, and my friends do this too. Half of you probably do this too. It's like, I'm only drinking when I'm out. I'm only drinking when I'm home. I'm not drinking when I'm out. I'm not drinking when I'm home. Only drinking when I'm 200 miles or more from home. I'm only drinking when I'm 200 miles or less from home. I'm only drinking in months that begin in J, or, you know, whatever. None of that stuff works. I have these friends who do this thing. In January, they don't drink except for when they're 200 miles away from home. They take a vacation every January. So I know I'm not alone in this. But guess what? When I decided, I really thought, you know, I really might be drinking too much. I stopped drinking for a year. For a year, no alcohol passed my lips. And that I found easy because it was like a little game, and I'd wake up in the morning and I'd say, I'm not going to drink today. And by the time dinner came, I'd say, okay, well, I don't drink. I'm not drinking for this month, and maybe it's going to be longer. And then suddenly it was a year. So I could do that. So I figured I needed to follow a pattern like that. But I didn't think I was actually strong-willed enough to not eat meat for a year, which would have been an interesting experiment. But I decided that I would break food because I had all of this stuff in my head. I decided that I would look at my personal seesaw and say, I'm just going to lighten this load and lower this load, but I know I can't be so mushy about it saying it like that because in 3 days I'll backslide and that'll be that. So I decided that from dawn until dusk, I was going to eat only from this side of my personal little seesaw. I was going to eat only whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, and nuts. And I do. I'm not kidding. And I have for 2 years. And do I cheat? Yeah, but like once a month. I don't cheat for the most part. It's not that hard. So then I do that. And then at night, I eat all the crap from this side that I want to. If I want to go out with my friends to some fancy-ass restaurant in New York, I do that. If I want to go out, it doesn't, you know, whatever. If I want to make pasta with sausages at home, I do that. I do whatever I want to do. But I felt like this side, first of all, my meat consumption plummeted, probably by half or more. But also, I ate a lot of white bread, which I think, which, you know, I love. I mean, the crust is really, it's one of the great inventions ever. But I think I ate it routinely all the time a lot. So, and I didn't, like, make a point in the old days. I didn't make a point of eating fruits and vegetables. So I did this for a while, like a month, and I had to go buy new pants. And I'm not kidding. I had to go buy new pants. And I didn't even weigh myself. I was just trying to do the cholesterol thing first. So I weighed myself. I'd lost 15 pounds. This is, I mean, you can't look it up, but this, you have to take my word for this. So then I thought, this is very self-reinforcing. I'm walking around with a smug smile on my face because I'm personally saving humanity in terms of the global warming thing. All these animals are not giving their lives for me. I'm losing weight. I'm not going to have a heart attack or diabetes. It's fabulous. Not even a stroke, maybe. But then I found that I remember it started because I kind of liked this stuff. So then I thought, well, the more I force-fed myself this stuff from this side of my seesaw, the better. And not that I was like skipping down the street, but I felt better. I was losing weight. I felt better. I felt like I was doing myself, everybody else a favor. And I also was enjoying it more. Like I could eat an apple and say, this is a really shitty apple. I wish I weren't eating it. Or I can eat an apple and say, this is just really a terrific eating experience. And the more I get into it, the more I would appreciate the very simple things. And I eat, I am totally like, I've been accused of many things, but like, I'm very far from being a vegan or a vegetarian. I'm even farther from being a raw food advocate. But then it turns out, gee, I'm eating a lot of raw food. Because if you're on the road, or you're even at work and you can't figure out what to do, you can always go to a store and buy like two apples, two oranges, and a bag of celery. And, you know, that's not going to be the best lunch you ever had in your life, but it's okay. So this stuff kind of worked for me. But now I'm like, again, so then it, And this worked. 2 years, I think, is a long enough experiment. The good news is you're going to have me around for a while, and my doctors are all very happy, and even my knees are better. So that's all good. But I'm not going to stand here and say, eat the way I eat. I'm going to stand here and say this. Look at your personal seesaw and start eating consciously and start saying, could I have an apple instead of a bag of chips? Could I have a vegetable soup, maybe even a vegetable stew with some sausage in it instead of a beef stew with a little teeny bit of vegetables in it? Could I have a little more sauce and a little less pasta, a little more vegetable sauce and a little less pasta? Could I have oatmeal for breakfast instead of bacon and eggs? Could I have rice and beans for dinner instead of beef stew? And so on down the line. And make those decisions on a case-by-case basis, but with an overarching view towards doing this. And remembering all the devastating consequences of eating heavily on this side of the seesaw, and all the beneficial consequences of eating on this side of the seesaw. Now, I'm going to have a sip of water. I guess most speakers don't tell you that, but full disclosure. There are two issues I have to address. And then I'm going to ask you a question or two, and then we can take your questions. Maybe there's only one issue I want to address. The other one will probably come back to me. Oh, yeah, the one that didn't come back to me that did? It's cheaper to eat this way. I didn't really think about that, but it's cheaper to eat this way because processed food is... I don't have to tell you that cornflakes are more expensive than oatmeal. I don't have to tell you that low-budget gourmet is not a cheap way to eat, or Weight Watchers frozen stuff. These are not inexpensive foods. I don't have to tell you that if you go into the store and you buy rice, beans, fresh vegetables, and fruits, you can buy as much of that kind of stuff as you carry for $40. And okay, in the summer you go to the farmer's market and you do that, and it's $80, but still, it's cheaper than processed food. But this brings me to the big point, and I have to address this issue. I think this is a preemptive strike, because if I don't, someone's going to ask me the question in a way I can't deal with it as well as I can if I address it up front. The bottom line here is to adjust your personal seesaw. You can gorge on plants, right? You can eat as many plants as you can stand. You will be fine. And if there were more time, I could get into the nutritive value of plants and how we've been sold a bill of goods on protein and blah, blah, blah. But for now, you can read the book, you can look online at other sources or whatever. Trust me, you will never get sick if you eat more plants than more of this stuff. You will be a healthier, probably svelter person. That is for sure. Now someone's going to say, and I said this whole thing yesterday, have I used the word organic? No. Have I used the word local? No. Or maybe I did, but I don't think so. I said all of this on a radio interview yesterday, a much shorter one, but I said... You can't ramble as much on the radio. But I said all this stuff, and the woman said, well, some people can't afford local organic food. And I was on my couch, and I fell onto the floor. I said, who said anything about local or organic food? Pas moi. So, or it's like people say to me, well, I'm not ready to become a vegetarian. I'm like, hello? Was there someone saying we should become vegetarians in here? Here's another thing I'll address. P.S. Being a vegetarian, I don't mean to offend. I'm really trying my best not to offend anyone because I can be a very offensive person. But being a vegetarian, unless you have a deep personal reason for being a vegetarian makes no sense whatsoever. Being a vegetarian, if you, there's people who hate me for saying this too, so let's not get carried away. But my reasoning behind this is, if you take that half a pound of meat that you're eating a day and swap it for anything else on this side of the equation, i.e. cheese, sour cream, Hershey bars, potato chips, pizza, whatever, you're not doing anyone a favor. You're not doing yourself a favor. You're not doing the environment a favor. And you're not even doing the cute little billions of animals a favor, because animals that are used for dairy production or egg production in the case of chickens are tortured just as much as animals that are used for meat production, and maybe more because they live longer, which is not necessarily a benefit in their case. So that's my argument against vegetarianism, but I'm not going to argue in favor of veganism because it would be like the most hypocritical thing in the world. All I'm saying, once again, I'm not saying don't eat meat. I'm saying do this. Get this side a little lighter. Okay, so now I'm saying eat more plants. And someone says, well, look, you know, local plants can be very expensive. So I think it's very nice if plants are local. Really, it's great. It's fabulous. Down here, you know, we have New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, God knows. Up where I live, we get stuff from upstate New York and from Vermont, beautiful stuff, for 4 months of the year, maybe six at best. If you were eating local plants right now, you'd be eating turnips and cabbage and carrots and potatoes and maybe a couple of other things. And you'd be saying, maybe we should drive to North Carolina and see if we can get some of them collards they grow down there. Because those are starting to sound pretty good, and this local stuff is getting to me. I mean, how much sauerkraut can we be eating, hon? And then I feel the same thing about organic. I mean, organic is great. And, you know, the sales of organic food, they announced this week, the sales of organic food have tripled in the last 7 years. Tripled. But, you know, organic processed breakfast cereal with malted rice syrup is still crap. And organic candy bars are still crap. Organic fruit juice is still crap. I could go on. The way I am is you kind of have to live my life with me a little bit, because this is new, a kind of new, because of course as part of the food movement, which I reluctantly am, I'm in favor of organic and local stuff. I mean, you can't say organic, you can't say local, who needs local? We do need local, we do want organic, but we want good stuff. But at the end of the day, it is about eating more plants than anything else. So your choice is, you have like McDonald's over here, and you have, just so I use a brand name from someone who's a friend of mine but no longer has any involvement with the company, so there's no conflict of interest. You have McDonald's over here, you have Nyman Ranch beef over here. So you have a very clear choice. You have broccoli flown in from Peru here, and you have broccoli from your neighbor's garden lovingly tended here. The choices are completely clear. No one's going to, if you can afford it, you go for the good stuff, right? On each side of this equation. That's not the real choice. The real choice is between the broccoli and the meat. And you got to choose the broccoli. That's the real choice. So local, great. Organic, great. Those are not the burning issues. If you want a garden and you want to raise your own food, my God, more power to you. You're going to eat more plants. And when I had a garden, I ate tons of plants. But that's the big issue. Now, I think I'm actually done. I want to do a quick little market survey. Then we're going to start the revolution, and then we'll take your questions. I also think you should, if you have questions, you should probably go get online, because the first people to ask questions actually get to ask their questions, and then the people who think later, oh, it's not so bad, I'm not that shy after all, don't get to ask their questions. So you might, there's two microphones, one at the back of each aisle, one at the front of each aisle. So if you want to ask questions, you can get. But in the meantime, if I say the word less meatarian to you, you know what it means, right? Is this a word I can be throwing around with some kind of confidence that people won't? Seriously. Because it's not, it's like, I am not a crook. I am not a vegetarian. I think the word flexitarian is completely stupid. It doesn't work for me. I'm a less meatarian. I mean, I could say I'm a more plantarian, but then it gets even crazier. So, but less meatarian's okay, right?
A mini-meatarian.
I'll put it in the hopper. You know, I have like 2 hours worth of conversations a day with my compadres about this kind of stuff. It drives us all nuts. What were we doing today? Well, anyway. The question I want to ask of you, and, you know, this is,
We don't know. I mean, I know two people in this audience, maybe three. So we don't know each other, but we are. I could tell when I came in. I could tell as where the event is. You know, we're in a big urban area on the East Coast. We know who each other are. So I don't think there are going to be. I don't think there are going to be a lot of people getting up here and saying, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. But if you are going to say that, I wish you would go to the front of the line because it would be interesting to hear why. My question for you is, and I guess I'm not really addressing this to you. I don't want you to start screaming out answers. But if you have comments that could address this question at the mics, I'd like to hear them. And that question is, what the hell are we going to do with this information? I mean, I told you what I did with this information, and I'm proud of a few things I've done in my life, and this is among them. So, I mean, I'm happy about this. It's a decision I make. It's a plan I made. I followed through. The results are good. What more can you ask out of life, really? So that's what I'm doing. Some of you are going to say, oh, this made some sense. Or, you know, I know some of you also are going to say, eh, I've been doing it for 3 years. Makes total sense. Any idiot could figure this out. Even I figured it out. That's fine, too. So it's going to affect some of your lives. It's going to confirm some things that some of you are doing already or advance some things that some of you are doing already. And my guess is that at least 80 or 90% of you are going to consider this at least a non-idiotic, if not intelligent, way to put forward the discussion about how we Americans eat. But the question is, and I said this before, the question is, I'm preaching to the converted here. How does this message get to people who don't come to talks like this? I mean, here's what I do. I like say yes when every television station calls me up and says, well, you'll be on to give your little spiel. And then I go on and talk to Ken and Barbie and, you know, and we do the TV thing. And I try to get as much stuff about this out. But I think the food movement, to the extent there is a food movement, is a little hung up in very esoteric and very effete stuff. And there's nothing wrong with heirloom vegetables. I love heirloom vegetables, but you are not going to change the way people eat with $6 tomatoes. This is not going to happen. So I really don't know. I don't feel like I'm stuck because I'm getting to talk to a lot of people and I'm getting to say this to a lot of people. But if anyone has ideas about how this might be taken further, how we might make this go viral without using Twitter. I'd like to hear that. And barring anyone having those ideas, I'd like all of you to tell someone you care about some of the stuff that I said tonight and maybe look on my website, which is going to be live any minute now. It's called markbittman.com. Actually, there's a back end. It's not live yet, but private showing, lesmeitarian.com. When it goes live, it's markbittman.com, but now we have it hidden away at lesmeitarian.com while we tinker with it. But, well, thank you. So let's take some questions. Don't clap yet. Save it. There are microphones. So why don't we make little lines here, of people, so you don't have to go walking up to them? I mean, I'm not the organizer here, but otherwise you have to go running around. It's the way we do it here at this place. All right, the guy. We'll take one from each side.
Is this one? Yes. Thank you. It's a very strange coincidence. I had a rather long meeting this afternoon with the nutritionist. Who's going to help me solve a whole bunch of different problems that have built up in my system over the years. I've got a few more on you. And 90% of what he was covering and telling me to do is very much like you've just said. Bring the meats down, bring up the vegetables and do all that stuff. So for any non-believers here, he's spouting the gospel.
Well, at least according to your nutritionist.
Well, okay. Exactly.
Thank you. We'll do is we'll sort of work our way back, I guess.
Thanks. Like you predicted, I very much agree with you. And I already tried not to eat meat during the day. I restricted to dinner. I guess my answer to your question and my question to you is I think what we need to do is provide people with options for these foods that we want them to choose when they're out. And I guess my question for you is what you generally choose for lunch when you go out. I have a lot of trouble keeping it vegetarian without a cheese sandwich, for example. And so I think that if we can provide people with foods that are good, that meet these criteria in restaurants and in, you know, cozy and snack shops, that they'll try it and then they'll like it.
Yeah, I guess. Certainly I can't disagree with you, but I think that there's a point at which we get to, we need to take responsibility for this ourselves. And like I said, you can buy a bag of apples and a bag of celery and you can eat that for lunch. And if that's not as satisfying to you as a cheese sandwich, then go buy some cashews because they're very satisfying. If that's not satisfying enough to you, then buy an avocado and keep a fruit knife at your desk and eat an avocado, and then you'll be satisfied. I mean, I have found that I can gorge on this stuff. And there are days when I think, I really don't feel like dealing with food at all today. I'm going to buy 8 or 10 pieces of fruit and some cut-up vegetables, and that's it. And it's not a day of great eating in the sense that you're excited all the time, but you don't get that hungry, and you feel terrific at the end of the day, and you're sort of stuck to it, which makes you feel a little better. So when I come into a strange city, and I didn't do this today because, like I said, I like Philadelphia. It doesn't feel strange. But when I go into a strange city, I often go to a supermarket first thing, and I just buy a bag of whatever looks okay. And then I have some stuff in the car or on the train or wherever I am that I know I can eat. Cozy and places like that are huge problems because they'll sell you a banana for $1, and you're going to be annoyed knowing that bananas are $0.25, you know, everywhere else. So you're going to, like, not buy that banana. Well, I'm going to spend $1. I might as well get a corned beef sandwich for $6. And there is something to that. When they start losing, I mean, in the vending machines at the Times, we have, like, you know, the Times is all this green building and shit. It's not. The vending machines at the Times are filled with, like, utter crap. Filled with crap. And then so no one was, you know, they know what you're buying and what you're not buying. The vending machine people, they're not entirely stupid. So now they have, like, upscale organic crap. So they have, like, soy chips instead of potato chips and stuff like that, you know, low-fat wheat thins. And you're thinking, well, we're getting close. There might be something we can eat here in another year or two. But will they put an apple in the vending machine for 50 cents? No. So you have to... You know, it's funny. When I first wrote Food Matters, I'm sorry, I'm not going to get to a lot of questions this way, I realize. When I first wrote Food Matters, I thought this is really a departure for me. There's a lot of words all in a row without numbers. It's not as directional as my recipes, which people have complained are not directional enough as is. This is really different. It has a message, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, at the end of the day, what I've been doing for 30 years is trying to convince people to take control of the food that they eat. And this is the same thing. It's not about – it's now it's a little bit – before it was more about learn how to cook because you can really control what it is you eat. And now it's more like control what it is you eat. And by the way, cooking is a really integral part of that. But it's not all that different, and it's really about – you're not going to let your life be run by what the marketers tell you is out there and what the USDA is telling you is good for you. Okay, I'll stop there. We're going to go back to this side. Why don't you, I don't want to be the bad guy. Why don't you pick one of these people? And
well, I want to sort of try to answer your question. I'm a physician, and I find that trying to tell people about nutrition is just about impossible. I mean, tell them about it, but getting them to change their attitudes is pretty hard. It seems to me that all the things that you're talking about, and Michael Pollan and Marion Nestle and all those people, it comes from advertising for corn syrup and for fast food and all that stuff. And until somebody decides that they're going to be the responsible party, government, whatever, to advertise in a contrary way, to advertise this stuff to people and push it in the same way that this junk was pushed on people for 50 years, mm-hmm. Until that happens, we're not going to change. You can talk to a few people. I can talk to a few people. It's not going to make much of a difference.
Well, there's an argument to be made that you know, when we were growing up, there were not vending machines in schools. So this is a big issue for a lot of people, and a very smart issue, because if there's not vending machines in schools, then kids drink water. You know, it's like, okay, so now you're drinking water. Guess what? That 7% of negative calories is gone. Well, good for you. Good for you. So, I mean, it is kind of stuff like that. I mean, it's poco a poco, as we say. There's a guy right to your left.
Hi. Yeah, my opinion is I think that people like you and Michael Pollan have got to, like, spread the word, get it built into the culture so people have these thoughts in their head. But I think the next step is when somebody gets in the back room of government and does something like flipping the farm subsidy policies, and at that point meat gets priced the way it should be and the homegrown vegetables start coming back to the Midwest. At that point, I have a firm belief that Americans will eat what's put in front of them. And it's priced that way. And
well, if meat were priced fairly, it would be three or four times as expensive as it is. Forget the subsidies. I mean, go ahead. I don't want to get in your way. Forget the subsidies. If the environmental costs of meat were billed back to the people who were raising meat industrially, the costs would be phenomenal. Go right through the roof. They'd all go out of business. So then what? Then you're at your 10 billion animals a year goes back down to 1 billion, which is still a pretty big number, but it's a number that would make some kind of sense. I mean, I used to buy half a pig every winter, and I had a family of four, and I cooked a lot, and I had a lot of friends, and that half a pig was enough meat for 6 months for me and my family. So, you know, and friends and so on, because it's a lot of meat. But we're averaging 30 animals a year per person in this family. So maybe 25 of them are chickens. Maybe 29 of them are chickens. It's still a lot of animals. Okay, who do we have over here? Go ahead. You're in charge. I wanted a line. I'm telling you, a line makes more sense. Survival of the fittest.
One of the problems is that if you do get the price of meat down, let's say, if it goes down, then people eat more meat. It's sort of like the paradox with oil and petroleum. I've noticed, for instance, that in Philadelphia we have an outbreak of steakhouses. All of a sudden there's a steakhouse on every other corner, and I'm wondering whether that has to do with the price of meat actually going down, making steakhouse restaurants more profitable and therefore pushing more meat on the public. And the second question is, why don't you get this message to President Obama? Because if he came out one day and he said, you know, we're going vegetarian, that would probably do it.
Well, we're trying to talk to President Obama, but so are many other people. The reason there are restaurants at all is because they can charge a lot of money for ordinary food. So if you can take something like a steak, even a good steak, and it costs you $20 wholesale for a really, really good steak, and you can charge $60 for it and tell people it's really a good steak, that's a very nice markup. Try doing that with a head of broccoli. It's just not going to happen. I mean, I think we're going to see a lot of restaurants go out of business this year, which is going to be a lot. I think, I mean, I feel sorry for people when they lose their jobs, but I think it's going to be fun to see restaurants go out of business because they have been bloodsuckers for a long time. People cook at home. They will learn a lot more about food. They will know what's better. They will know what's worth money and what's not worth money, and that's a really good thing. But in the meantime, one of you has to take people in the middle also. What can I tell you? I wanted a lie.
Hi. Okay. Hi. So my question actually is about people losing their jobs, because I do sort of wonder, there has been such an industry built around processed food and meat slaughtering and bringing it all out to market. And I sort of think of these people, this is awful. Like, all of this factory work is horrible, but these are people who have jobs and who these jobs are matter to them. So how do we, if we were to flip everything and make it, you know, more about sustainable agriculture and more vegetables, less meat, how, I'm just wondering this myself. Like, yeah. Is there an economic consequence?
Well, it's not worth wondering about. It's really not worth wondering about. I'm sorry.
Because it sucks, and that's just how it's going to be.
There's new jobs in other industries. Look, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Would you like to see our troops withdrawn from Iraq?
Sure.
Okay. And if as a result of that, we reduce the number of people in the armed forces by, say, 100,000 people, is that a consequence you're willing to live with? Because these are poor people. People who go in the Army now are poor people, right? So these people are going to get thrown out of the Army or not be allowed to reenlist or whatever. That's a consequence. Everything
right.
has – let me just finish.
Yeah.
Everything has a consequence. By breathing, we have an impact on the earth and on everything else. By eating vegetables, we have an impact on the earth and everything else. The economy stuff is way too big for me or anybody else to figure out. People are going to lose jobs. People are going to find jobs. This stuff is going to happen. I can't sit here and this stuff that I'm saying all makes sense. I can't throw into this equation how to reemploy the people who are making unhealthy food for us once they're laid off because we all make the right decision and stop eating that crap. Maybe they should start looking for other jobs now. I don't know. But right now, they have jobs making stuff that's poisoning the rest of us. So I just can't worry about them in that context.
Huh. Okay.
I want this gentleman right here, please, because he's had his hand up from the beginning. And then we're taking one more question, which will be from the person sitting furthest in the back who raises his or her hand.
Well, in all this discussion, you don't have to be around very long, but if you're older than maybe 40... The elephant in the room is the knowledge that despite everything we're saying and agree with and how wonderful it all is, people are living longer and healthier than in any time in recorded human history here in this United States.
Well, actually, the United States has the 45th highest life expectancy in the world, following a number of countries.
Yeah, but we're living longer than we ever did here.
Yeah, we're living longer than we ever did here, but we're not living as long as we could be living.
Well, that's true, but the argument people would make who would resist what we're saying here.
Well, yeah, but some of these advances are from vaccination, they're from public health, they're from stopping smoking, they're from this and that. They don't necessarily have to be attributed to better nutrition.
Let me get into numbers. How do you tease out how much is because of what? You know.
Well,
even the lousy potato chips I wouldn't eat are fortified with vitamins and blah, 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 blah. You know,
well... You have the information. It's your choice to make. I mean, our life expectancy could be much higher than it is.
I agree, but it's...
I would argue that our diet is keeping it back, not advancing it. I would argue that the most important public health inventions of the last 500 years have been things like indoor plumbing, running water, vaccinations. Those have had the hugest impact on stuff. Now, I think at this point our diet is holding us back from living healthy lives until, you know, one of the reasons also life expectancy is longer is because people like my dad, who, had he lived in any other era than he lived in, would have died at 50, but he had coronary bypass surgery. That's not because he had a good diet, let me tell you. So, you know, I mean, you're not wrong, but you have to... I'm not going to convince you either. You need to figure out, you tease out the numbers, see what you think. I don't think you're eating a bad diet, so you're just being mean.
I'm in.
It's an inconvenient question.
The furthest back person, please. Hey.
Okay, I want to know if you ate at a restaurant in Philadelphia tonight and what you ate for dinner.
I am eating in a restaurant in Philadelphia tonight, but I'm being escorted, and I don't know what it's called, and I'm not going to find out until after I leave. So,
wah, wah.
A little bit of an anticlimax, that question, but hey, thank you. No, we got to stop. I think we're going to be signing books upstairs. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.